Good afternoon, everybody, again. This is the 3 o'clock half an hour Dharma talk session. For those streaming around the world, this is Jhana Grove Retreat Center. I'm Venerable Mudu. I'm conducting weekend retreat at Jhana Grove in Western Australia. And this is an afternoon Dharma talk. So hopefully everybody's just starting to settle into their little huts and getting comfortable. It takes a little while. You kind of move away from your own comfortable house and you have to get used to a new bed. It's not always easy. It takes a little bit of time, but hopefully you've settled in. You've got a nice little nest in your bedroom and comfortable. You've had enough rest, because that's quite an important thing to do. Make sure you get enough rest. That's probably the main thing I'd be recommending, is make sure you get rest, so that when you do do some meditation, that you're less likely to kind of nod off or fall asleep. So I gave myself quite a bit of time. I came a week earlier to this retreat and made sure I was quite well rested, or I tried to. It didn't work out that way, because when I got here, Ajahn Brahm had a very busy program for me. So it didn't end up being as much rest as I would have liked. And everywhere that I went, supporters that hadn't seen me for a long time were kind of quite excited to see me. So it was quite busy. Lots of house dhanas and restaurant dhanas and stuff like that. But I managed to get in a couple of days of good rest before coming to do the retreat. So you may have heard me talking about lots of kindness to the body, kindness to the mind when we do the meditation. And these are things that, at least Ajahn Brahm holds, priority, really highest importance, being kind to yourself, being kind to your mind. And these put in the foundations for a good meditation practice. I remember when I was younger, I didn't know much about meditation. I didn't know much about Buddhism. But what I did know, I got from television, documentaries. And I remember seeing meditators or monks from other Asian countries. And, they would always try to portray this image of what a monk represented in these documentaries. And what clearly I remember in my mind was seeing these monks. They looked very austere, very serious. They didn't laugh or smile. And when they meditated, it was always in really crazy positions, like on the edge of a cliff, on a hard rock. And I thought, gee, that's what meditation is. And then when I come to learn from Ajahn Brahm, I find out it's not like that. That's not how he teaches. He, instead of a cliff and an edge of a rock, it's cushions and a nice comfortable seat in an air-conditioned room. So sometimes these stereotypes kind of lead you astray. So I do see lots of people that come to the monastery and they have the same idea I had, or Westerners. They think that it's a path where you grit your teeth and you put forth lots of effort and lots of willpower. And I guess I must have kind of had the same idea, even though I heard Ajahn Brahm say what you're supposed to do, that stereotype was so fixed in my mind that I thought, it just can't work. Being kind, that's just too soft. How can that work? Where's the effort in that? So, you know, Ajahn Brahm teaches this, but Venerable Mudu is smarter than Ajahn Brahm, so he decides that he's got to put forth effort and go hard. So all you end up doing is just hurting yourself. But sometimes that's the way we learn, hurt ourselves until we find a way that works. So eventually you go, Ajahn Brahm must be right. I'll try what he suggested and just be really kind to myself. Get some extra cushions. And if you saw this afternoon when I came in, I brought another one. So I'm slowly adding these cushions to my little seat. I remember one time we actually have to do, every 2 weeks, we have to shave our head and shave our beard. And then all the monks get together and they have a community meeting which we call Patti Mokka. Patti Mokka is where we recite all of the 227 rules that the monks keep. And then if anyone breaks a rule, they're supposed to put their hand up or tap the monk on the leg that's next to you and say, I broke that rule. I confess I broke that rule. Or you can actually confess them as you break them. And then you try not to break that rule again. And so we have to sit for 45 minutes. That's how long it takes to chant the Patti Mokka in Pali. And we were doing the chanting before from this book, and you heard some of the Pali that we were chanting. Well, there's one monk that has to recite the whole Patti Mokka without looking at the book. It's not this book, it's way thicker than this. It's like 80 pages long. And these monks remember the whole lot of this Patti Mokka. I haven't learnt it yet. I actually learnt the first 20 pages, and then I got sent down to Albany. It was just far too much work to learn it. So I've put it on hold, the Patti Mokka. But it's there's only a handful of monks at Serpentine that can actually do it. It's not an easy task. You've got to kind of remember all these 80 pages off by heart without looking at the book. So you've got to sit for 45 minutes. And, you know, it's a long time. You're not really meditating, so you're kind of aware of your body and you get aches and stuff. So I follow Ajahn Brahm's instructions and make myself comfortable. And one of the monks, you might know him, Ajahn Santuti. Ajahn Santuti has the hermitage, it's like an Albany hermitage, but it's in Kelmscott. It's called the Kusala Hermitage. He ran a weekend retreat here not so long ago as well. And he's a very cheeky monk. So he saw all of my cushions. And he said, "Mudu, how come you've got so many cushions?" I said, "I'm just making myself comfortable. It's just a couple of cushions." He said, "That's not a couple of cushions. That's an armchair." So he's a very cheeky monk. He's a very happy monk too. We like him a lot. So that's how I'd be kind to myself. I just make sure I'm comfortable. I do from time to time suffer from sciatica. Some of you might know what that is. This kind of funny pain that goes down your leg, comes and goes. And so you've got to be comfortable. And that's just all part of being kind. So it's come up a lot in this retreat, the kindness. It's a strong part of my practice. And so when I got asked to teach this retreat, I didn't make any plans on what I was going to teach, because this is the Thai forest tradition. We don't make plans, we speak from the heart. You kind of bounce off the audience's reactions. they'll start yawning, then you talk about something else. But so far, this talking about kindness, it seems to have been received fairly well. So I thought I'd share a story Ajahn Brahm shared with me not only a few days ago about a kind word or right speech, we call in Buddhism, kind of using words that are gentle and kind. And I think it's called Nandiya Wasali. And some of you might know it. Here's a story about this farmer and his ox. And this farmer and his ox were getting very old. And the ox said to the farmer one day that, he said, "Dear master, I'm getting very old. I think we should retire. This is... you know, we're getting too old for this work and farming and pulling carts and stuff around." So Nandiya Wasali, the ox, said to the farmer, and this was before Disney, when, you know, animals could talk. So yeah, this was a talking ox. He said to the farmer that go into town and speak to the rich man and tell him you want to have a bet with him. And at that time, I don't know what their monetary system was, but it would be equivalent to what some sort of significant savings you might have, $100,000, let's say. He said to bet the rich man in the town $100,000 that your ox, Nandiya Wasali, could pull 100 carts full of stones. And so the farmer went into town, saw the rich man, put on the bet, and later on the whole of the town turned up to watch this what seemed like a ridiculous stunt that was going to be almost like what they call in Australia a gimme, a freebie. So free money to this rich man, because this old ox, I mean, how crazy he thought it was to be able to pull 100 carts full of stone. So the whole town turned up to mock this old farmer and his ox, to laugh at him. So they hooked up all of the carts, filled them full of stone, and then yoked the carts to the ox, Nandiya Wasali. And once the ox was yoked to these carts, or linked up to the carts, kind of with the ropes and all the bridle gear, the farmer commanded Nandiya Wasali, "Pull the carts." Nothing happened. Nandiya Wasali just stood there. So this time he said, "Pull the carts, you stupid ox. What are you doing?" And still Nandiya Wasali just stood there, did nothing. So the next time the farmer hit Nandiya Wasali with a stick and said, "Pull these carts." Still Nandiya Wasali did nothing. So all of the townspeople were laughing as this farmer had lost the bet to the rich man and had to pay him $100,000. So the poor old farmer, he went and sat under the tree and started crying. And after a little while, he could feel a wet nose on his ear. Nandiya Wasali came up to the farmer and said to him, "Master, why are you crying?" And the farmer told him, "Well, you told me you could win the bet and pull these 100 carts, yet you did nothing." And Nandiya Wasali said, "Well, you were very mean to me. You were very cruel. You commanded me to pull the carts. Then you said awful words to me. You were unkind, and then you hit me with a stick. And then the farmer realized what he'd done wrong. His companion, his life companion, his good friend, the ox, he was mean to the ox. It's no wonder he didn't want to pull the carts and win the bet. So Nandivasali said to the farmer, go back and see the rich man. Tell him you want to double your bet, $200,000. And I'll pull those carts, master. So the farmer went back to the rich man, doubled his bet. All the townspeople laughed at him, said he'll never pull those carts. So they yoked up the ox again to the carts, and this time the farmer said, dear Nandivasali, please pull the carts. My good friend stroked him on the head, patted him a couple of times, and Nandivasali, he mustered up as much energy as he could, and he sweated. He had steam coming out of his ears. He tried as hard as he could, but still couldn't pull the carts. The farmer said to him, oh, Nandivasali, please stop. I don't want you to hurt yourself. I don't want you to die. I'd rather lose the money and still have you as my dear friend. And Nandivasali, with those kind words, he gave it another try. And this time the steam really came out of his ears. He was sweating all over his body, and his eyes were just about to pop out of his head. But still, nothing happened, and the carts wouldn't move. And if, for those of you who know Buddhism, three times. On the third time, the farmer said, oh, please, don't hurt yourself, Nandivasali. But of course, on the third time, he mustered up all his energy, and his eyes were really about to pop out of his head this time. But then there was this sound, creak. The wheels started to turn, and the first cart started to move, and then the second, and then the third, and after a short while, all 100 carts moved. And a little bit longer after that, the 100th cart had moved to where the first cart was. And he won the bet. So they had a nice retirement package, lots of money, and they lived happily ever after. So that's the story of Nandivasali, and it's about using right speech. And so when you're kind and you use kind words, you can get things to happen. You use harsh words, unkind words, then you're not really going to achieve much because people get hurt. So that's the Nandivasali story. That's quite good. Ajahn Brahm, if you get to see him, ask him to tell you that story, and you might shed a tear like I did when he told me. Because Ajahn Brahm is a very good storyteller. So I quite like that story. So this kindness, yeah, very, very important. Always remember that, and that it does fall in line with the Buddha's teaching. He always talked about the middle way. Those of you who don't know, this kind of story about the middle way, one of the most well-known kind of understandings of how the Buddha became enlightened was he went to all these teachers. He was obviously, you probably know, he was from a royal family, so he was a prince. So he had everything he needed, or that his father thought he needed, you know, plenty of money, different houses, one for the summer, one for the winter, and different palaces. But the Buddha decided to go off and do the ascetic, or choose the life of a samana, and try to find enlightenment. And he did practice very hard. He must have seen the same documentaries I saw, because he tried very, very hard. And he even went so far as to emaciate himself. So he did find a group of other monks. These weren't Buddhist monks at the time, because there was no Buddhism at the time. It was only Buddhism after the Buddha kind of became enlightened and passed away. Then they recognized this path that he'd put forth as Buddhism, because he was the leader of this path. But he hung out with these five friends, samanas, or alms bowl mendicants, so people that carry the alms bowl. It's not just Buddhist monks that did that. There's lots of other sects and religions that did that in the time of the Buddha. So he and these other five monks were all practicing together. And at that time, they believed that going hard was the way to go. And they did the sorts of practices that were very, very cruel on the body. So the Buddha became... He was practicing eating like a one grain of rice a day and very little water, until he became so emaciated that all of his ribs were showing, his stomach, he could apparently touch his backbone through his stomach. There was nothing hardly there. All the hair was falling out of his body, and pretty much just about close to death. And he was wise enough to recall when he was a young boy. He remembered sitting under the rose apple tree while his father was taking part in some festival. So he sat under the tree and did this meditation and got into this jhana stage of meditation, very deep stage of meditation as a young boy. And he recalled how he did that, and that wasn't through putting forth any effort. It was just by just sitting there and letting go. So he recalled that event and just realized that this ascetic way of practice, going really hard, wasn't the way to go. And he went to see, he went walking and decided that the middle way was the way to go. Not being too comfortable, not being too tough, but choosing a middle way. And I think that's different for everybody. Everybody's idea of a middle way is different. What is too extreme for someone is not the same for someone else, and what's too soft for someone isn't the same as someone else. So the Buddha was sitting under this tree where this one of these supporters who was a wealthier lady who had a servant, and the servant went to this tree to offer like a gift or a gift for the gods. She put it under this tree, and when she approached the tree, she saw what she thought was one of the gods ready to receive this food. But it was the Buddha-to-be, Siddhartha Gautama. And she got quite excited. She ran back to she was what they call a handmaiden. I think that's a translation they use in the suttas. She ran back to the farmhouse and told the lady of the house that one of the devas had come down to receive her meal, that she must come and see. So she personally went to the tree, and the Buddha-to-be was under the tree. And he said, "No, I'm not a deva, I'm just a human being." But he received the meal nonetheless, and it was this famous dish that Sri Lankans offer often at the temple, called milk rice. And it's quite a fine dish. It was worthy of offering to the devas. And the Buddha ate some of that, and he got his strength back. And once he got his strength back, then he had the energy to meditate. And he could, before he was just so emaciated, close to death, And he realized that it was this path to enlightenment was a middle way. But at the same time, his mates, these other five ascetics, saw him taking the milk rice. And they all waved their fingers at him and said, "He's off the path. He's gone soft, and he's taking it easy. He's not a real samana." And so they abandoned him as their companion. And it was very soon after that, the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, which we have an original descendant of that Bodhi tree at Serpentine, if you didn't know. They're not easy to come by, but we have one. For those of you who don't know, it's at Serpentine. As you drive in the gate and you go down to that little roundabout thing, it's on the left. It's the Bodhi tree on the left there. A fair dinkum, original descendant of the one the Buddha sat under. So you can tell when you see that tree. It's different than the rest. It really does glow. It's got this... I kid you not, you go check it out. You've probably driven past it many times and not realised that. Not many people know. But that's a real descendant of the original Bodhi tree. And there's also one at the Nuns Monastery. They're not easy to come by. Their place in Sri Lanka, very, it's guarded, protected. But in Sri Lanka they've got... a descendant of the original Bodhi tree, which was taken by one of the nuns. Is it Sanghamitta? Sanghamitta, this daughter of King Ashoka, isn't it? And so you can put in special requests to get not a cutting from this tree, because you can't cut the tree. Because that's it's too sacred to cut pieces off it. They wait till the fruits form and they get the seeds from the fruits, and then the monks there nurture those little seedlings. And if you're someone like Ajahn Brahm, then it's a lot easier to get hold of one. So we have two of them, one here, Serpentine, one at the Nuns Monastery, and I've got my fingers crossed for one at Albany. So yeah, the Buddha sat under that Bodhi tree, and using what he kind of described as the middle way, he became enlightened doing the breath meditation. And and that's that middle way. It does imply kindness, being kind to the body and not going to extremes of going too hard. So that's why I said on the first night, I said, you know, you can substitute any of these words on here for sleep. Because if you need to sleep, then you should do it. The body says you need to rest, then you should rest. And there's plenty of opportunities on this program to have rest and come to the talks, hear a little bit of Dharma, share group meditation. And these are powerful group meditations. It's, you know, when I first started meditating, I always thought, oh, group meditations are for beginners. And when I became a monk, so I don't need group meditations anymore. I'm past that. I'm advanced. I'm a monk. I'm a Buddhist monk. And now that I'm privileged to actually be able to teach meditation again, I've rediscovered how good these group meditations are. They are very powerful. And for me, I get some amazingly beautiful, delicious meditations on these group meditations, and it's partly due to all the people here with the pure hearts and wanting to do this same peaceful activity together. Actually, one of my Thai friends, the lovely Thai friend who introduced me to Buddhism many years ago, our daughters went to the same school, so I met her in Rockingham. And I owe so much to her for introducing me to Buddhism. And she... I can't remember. Where was I going? Completely lost where I was going. Anybody? I'm throwing a line out here.
Meditation.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. She would say that the group meditations are very... she was saying how good they were, and she would describe the group meditations like with a metaphor. She'd say that sometimes when you meditate by yourself at home, and I'm sure you've all tried this, and so quite often you can fall asleep, you nod off because you've been busy or whatever. And she said when you meditate on your own, it's like just burning one candle. But when you sit in a group meditation, it's like you're sharing this brightness of many, many candles. So 60 people here, and we often refer to the mind and its brightness, or the mind really does brighten up. And for me, with these group meditations, it's like there's many, many, many candles being lit. And that adds to this brightness of the mind. And I think it's a wonderful thing. So the group meditations, yeah, I kind of learnt not to knock them. They are very good. I was lucky enough to do group meditation with Ajahn Brahm, the Friday night meditation at Nolimara. So, yeah, it was. They're very good. So, yeah, there's someone was telling me the other day that, you know, over the years that the meditators have been meditating in this hall, just like they've been doing at Nolimara, the room does build up some sort of energy, some sort of positive, beautiful energy. And I definitely feel that in this room, just like I do with Nolimara. And we're getting the same sort of thing with the two places we meditate at in Albany. One of them's Albany and the other one is in Denmark. We use these two halls there, and they get very good meditations in those as well. So, yeah, the group meditations are very good. So just a couple of stories there about kindness and the middle way, not going too hard, and just finding your own middle way. Everyone's middle way is different. Find your own. It takes a while to fine-tune it. It's taken me, I don't know, 10 years living in monastery and another 5 years before that as a meditator. Yeah, so be patient. Just try this, try that. Add a cushion, take a cushion, give yourself a bit more rest, maybe meditate a bit less if you're pushing yourself too hard, trying to go for that hour and you're getting a sore leg or a sore back. Maybe just back off a bit. Just be happy with half an hour or 40 minutes or 20 minutes. Just find your own level. It will change over the years, and the more you meditate, you'll always tweaking it and fine-tuning it to find the most comfortable position for your body and the most comfortable mindset for yourself. And yeah, thank you for listening. It's only a short talk, just half an hour. So please enjoy the rest of the day. I know that there's some yoga now, is that right? So if you'd like to do some yoga, is that in here? Yeah, excellent. So I'll call it a day and see you guys tonight for some Q&A. I think it's Q&A, and that's at... there's chanting and guided meditation from 7:30, then Q&A. So 7:30 to 8, guided meditation. 8 to 10 past 8, chanting, and 10 past 8 to 9 o'clock, Q&A. So hopefully I'll see you guys then. Thank you. Sadhu.